Turn your radio on.
This is a download from Triple J.
Australia's national youth network. On radio,
on TV,
and online.
For more music, current affairs, comedy, and culture,
triplej.net.au.
And now?
Right now we have an ace man inside your radio. Wouldn't it be funny if you actually lived inside everyone's radio? Well, you kind of do.
Yeah, people say you're a lot taller than I thought you were, so they do think that I live inside the radio.
Could be your own little aerial. Dr. Carl is who we're talking to this morning, back from Taiwan and talking science with you. We're going to hear a little bit about your Taiwan travels in a little while, Dr. Carl, but how are you feeling? Are you over the lag? Are you over the jet lag? And do you have any tips on how to get over jet lag in a scientific way?
No food, no alcohol, immediately start walking around the city that you end up in. But it's virtually impossible because you've got one area sharing the same time. So imagine an area that goes from New Zealand through Sydney across to Perth and a couple of thousand kilometres the other side, all on one time zone, and that is China.
Big.
And so some people have sunrise around midday in the very western parts. That's just crazy.
Very crazy. All right, let's get into some questions this morning. 1-300-055-36 if you have a question. If you've got an answer for us, then you can tweet at Dr. Carl, DocTorKarl, or let us know on the forum your answers at triplej.net.au. There's a special thread dedicated to it. Let's head to the Northern Territory first. Kakadu, where Dash is, are you standing on the top of a ute?
I am.
What are you doing on the top of a ute, Dash?
Trying to get reception, I have to stand very still.
Oh, very good. What's your question for Dr. Carl?
Well, we've just come across the Gibb River Road in northwest Australia, and there's a lot of corrugations, and we're wondering what causes them, and is there any way to prevent them because they're terrible?
Yeah, I've had this too when I've been travelling through the outback. It's very annoying. What is it, Dr. Carl?
It's bumps. This was discovered by a guy called Keith B. Mather, M-A-T-H-E-R. This is from my 12th book, from the University of Melbourne back in 1962. And there's been some follow-up research, and basically he got it right. And what he did was he got an arm, a metal arm, about 1 metre long with a pivot, and he just ran a wheel around it. He just ran around in circles. So there's a little wheel on this 1 metre arm. It just goes around in circles, so you got a 2 metre diameter circle, you know, with a variable speed electric motor. And then he used different materials in his concrete track. He used dirt and fine sifted sand and gravel and rice grains and split peas and wheat and sugar and everything. And providing the materials were, number one, dry, and number two, did not stick together, he could always generate corrugations. Now, the corrugations would come very quickly if he had hard tyres, but they came slowly with soft tyres. And quicker in dry materials, but very slowly, if at all, when they're wet. And it made no difference whether the wheel was a driving wheel or a driven wheel or a steering wheel. The main factor was the road speed and the bumps. You can never make a road perfectly smooth. There'll always be tiny bumps. And once the wheel gets up to a certain minimum speed, which on his setup was about 7 kilometres per hour, it'll hit a tiny bump and then bounce a little hop and it'll go up and then come down and hit the sand, flour, sugar, rice grains, whatever it was, or even MSG. I actually had some MSG, an ounce of MSG. Anyway, that was in a restaurant here in China.
Good story. Anyway,
so it spray the sand both forwards and sideways off the track, leaving behind a little crater. So it goes up, comes down, leaves a crater, and when it comes around again, it'll jump into the air again. And so the pattern of valley and mountain would repeat itself. And if you've got in the outback a road that's been freshly graded and you've got a cattle grid, you can see over the course of several days the corrugation start walking, rolling, appearing down the road away from the cattle grid, getting longer and longer, but only on one side of the road, if people are sticking just to one side of the road.
Is it better to let your tyres down a little bit if you're going to have a long trip on a corrugated road? Is it better for them to be a bit softer?
It's better for the, number one, not causing the corrugations. Number two, you don't feel them so much.
Mm.
But number three, the sidewall will flex, and because they're working harder, will get very hot and you can destroy the tyre. And I've had this experience of some English people who rolled into an outback camping area which had this beautiful big lagoon in it, which was the only drinking water for 400 kilometres around, and they rolled in with the tyre on the back shredded. You could put your hand through the sidewall. It wasn't so much a tyre as rather strips of licorice, black licorice, held together every now and then. And one tyre had started to overheat. All of them were very hot. And I asked the guy, how long was he driving on the flat tyre for? He said, oh, no time. I just went flat. And I said, did you notice the steering funny? He said, oh, yeah. The steering was funny for about an hour. So he'd been driving on the flat tyre for about an hour. And then they didn't know the country. They then jumped into the lagoon, which is our only drinking water, and started washing their hair with shampoo and conditioner, the poor buggers.
Oh, I'm sure Dash would never do that. Does that answer your question, Dash?
That was fantastic.
Thanks for the call, mate.
Cheers.
See you later. Yeah, if you ever drive along that stretch of road, the Stuart Highway, between Port Augusta and Alice Springs, there's just tyre tread torn up all along the way. There's so many tyres that go to heaven on that road. Simon in Carina Downs, good morning.
Good morning.
What's your question for Dr. Carl? Hello, what's your question?
My question's about the universe. If it's 13 billion years old, or roughly 13 billion years old, and stretches 93 billion light years across, is it expanding faster than the speed of light?
Relative to us, I think I've got my cosmology right, yes. But we can't know about them because they're beyond the visibility horizon. So if they're halfway to the edge, in inverted commas, of the universe, they're travelling at half the speed of light. And if they're at the edge, whatever it is, of the universe, they're travelling at the speed. And relative to some stuff nearby them, they're not travelling really fast. But relative to us, they are. And so they sort of vanish from our knowledge. Does that kind of answer it?
Kind of. Now,
because remember when we had the wonderful mind mill with Sir Roger Penrose and Kip Thorne, yep. They pointed out that the speed of light, speed restriction in the universe is a local phenomenon. So if you've got things that are far enough away from each other, they can be moving relative to each other, that word relative, and simultaneously, whatever simultaneous means, at faster than the speed of light. It's only when things are close to each other that restriction applies.
Hey, thanks for the call, Simon.
Okay, thanks a lot, guys.
Good on you, mate. See you later.
I think, by the way, if a real cosmologist can ring in, I'd be very grateful.
1300 055 536, or you can tweet at Dr. Carl on Twitter if you're on board. James in Adelaide, good morning.
My question is about transport. If I was to put my brain in someone else's, where their brain was, would that have the same memory as I would have had?
Yeah, good question, Dr. Carl.
Look, memory is so poorly understood. We think, we're pretty sure, that memory actually exists in the brain. And you can have an intellectual memory, a mathematical memory, an emotional memory, a smell memory, a muscle memory. So in a martial arts or in cricket, you go through the same motions over and over again. And in this particular case, think about walking on a grass pathway. And eventually you begin to wear a rut in the surface, and it's easier to walk, the ground is flatter. And in the same way, you do the same thing in the nerves, if you're saying doing kicking or working a bat, in your spinal cord and your arm nerves, and that pathway is easy. If you're remembering your multiplication times tables, then in your brain there's a pathway that if you say 9 by 3, you go bing, 9 by 3, 27. And if you're dealing with a smell memory, like there's a Madeleine cake, or a meat pie that you really, really love, and then that goes down into your spinal cord, the very top, called the brain stem. We think that this is how memory is stored, and we think that it all exists within our body. But it could be, and this is fairly unlikely, that memory and consciousness exists all around us, and our brain is just a switchboard for tapping into it. I started up a file. This is how I normally work. When anything attracts my attention, I start up a file. And I started up a file on memory about 1985, and what's that, about 23 years?
24.
And we still haven't got the answer. The paper file got to be about 8 centimetres thick.
So when you talk, I mean, that's a pretty big concept, talking about that memory and consciousness are kind of all around us. When you say that, are you talking about things within our own bodies, like muscle memory and, like you say, the, you know, things at the top of your spine, stuff like that, Dr. Carl?
Yeah. Well
within your own body, though?
Yeah, well, not with memory, but with consciousness. Mm. We're pretty sure that memory exists in the body, but it might not. And we're almost certain, really, really quite certain, that consciousness exists in the body. Apart from the minor problem, we don't know where consciousness is or what it is. And I can almost, when I'm feeling fairly tired and might have had one or two little drinkies, think that our brains are just a switchboard and the consciousness exists around us. But unfortunately, there's no proof for that. It's a nice romantic gesture. Look, the easy way out with the information we have in 2009 is to think that it's all inside our bodies.
Does that make sense, James?
Yep.
Thanks for the call.
Kind of. It's a big one, Dr. James.
It's a very big question. And Dr. Carl was in Taiwan last week. And they're at a very important time. Carl, tell us about it.
Yeah, well, Taiwan was great. They got this weird situation in Taiwan where consistently the kids in high school do really, really well in science and maths and hate it and then immediately drop out as soon as they finish high school. And they all work, they do well because they work so hard. And there are literally three-year-old kids studying English language at 8 o'clock at night.
Oh, my gosh.
They should be in bed. And in China, when they say goodbye to you, they say, bye-bye, bye-bye, bye-bye. And it sounds so cute. And when you want to get a taxi in China, you put your arm straight out, horizontally, parallel to the ground, and then you wave your hand up and down, hello, sailor, and you sort of wave it up and down. You don't pull it, your hand towards you, and you attract them. And in the big cities in China, to be cool, the cool young things, wait for it, they drink Starbucks, eat KFC and use English words like disco and let's go.
I'm on board with the disco and let's go part of that equation.
Yeah. And did you see the big military parade they had for the 60th anniversary of the formation of the Chinese government?
No, I missed it. I saw that they were getting gearing up for those big celebrations in the last couple of
weeks.
It
was huge. The hotel that I was at, there was nobody allowed to stay there except military personnel because it overlooked the parade. And I just came in the day after the parade, so I was just amazingly lucky. And part of it were these women. Now, they were soldiers, and all Chinese military, paramilitary and police are as hard as the city pavement, and you don't want to stuff with them at all. Totally humorless when they're on the job. And there was this huge battalion of women wearing hot pink miniskirts and hot pink tops, clutching assault rifles. And I don't mean an Uzi, I mean an assault rifle that can kill a couple hundred people in a few seconds, wearing white go-go boots, white gloves, and white Jackie Kennedy pillbox hat.
Amazing.
While goose-stepping.
The golden days of communism.
Communism is different from 1949,
Are you going to post any of these photos on drcarl.com?
Okay, we'll send some more. I'll send some of me on wearing my Triple J T-shirt on the Great Wall of China.
It's a beautiful thing. All right, keep an eye on drcarl.com for some more pictures of that. I definitely want to see those pillbox hats and the rest. Deeds in Perth, good morning.
Good morning, Dr. Carl. Good morning, Dr. Zan.
Hello, what's your question?
My wife and I are talking about having babies, and my question is, I was wondering at the moment of making love and conception of the child, if our mood that we're in, like if we're very relaxed and sensual, has a different outcome on the personality of the child rather than if we were just a drunken, wild sex one when we come home from pub one night or a good night out together, you know what I mean?
So are there a zen baby or a trashy baby is what you're saying?
Yeah, would the child be better behaved or not so much better behaved but more of a relaxed child? Or would they be a bit more hyperactive?
Interesting question.
Mm. Well, in the old days, there was a thing called Lysenkoism, and a person called Lysenko, Lysenko, who thought that the environment could affect the living creature, the babies, the next generation. So giraffes were born with long necks because their parents kept on stretching all the time. And then we sort of learn more about genetics, discover the DNA, and the DNA is like a ladder, and your normal ladder is about 2 or 3 metres long, and it's got maybe a dozen rungs. The DNA ladder of life is 2 or 3 metres long, but it's got billions of rungs, and it's a blueprint, and people are saying, well, that's silly, you can't possibly have that happen. And now we're finding that you can. You affect not the DNA of the baby or the person, but chemicals are added to the ladder which affects how the ladder gets read. In other words, it's a blueprint. And so there was a study done with men who had prostate cancer, and the bottom line is that if you're going to live to the average life expectancy age as a man, you're going to have prostate cancer when you die, and it's not whether you're going to have it, but you are going to have it, but what sort, and it won't, in most cases, it won't kill you. So they, in this study, they had a whole bunch of guys who had prostate cancer, guys in their 50s, and it was not the sort of prostate cancer that was going to kill them. It was just going to be there, they're going to die of something else. And they gave half of them meditation, put them on a really good food diet, and put them onto exercise program. And the other half they did nothing for. And they then got little tiny needles and then sampled, stuck needles into the cancer and sampled it and looked at the DNA. And they found that if you just had your prostate cancer and you just lived regularly and had lots of beer and hammered yourself and ate saturated fats and all that sort of stuff, you switched on the genes that made the cancer grow faster and switched off the genes that slowed it down, so you made things worse. But if you did the exercise and meditation and the good food, blow me down, you slowed down the rate of growth of the cancer. You switched off the genes that made it grow and you switched on the genes that switched it off. So it does seem that your environment can affect not the DNA, but how the DNA is read. So that's as far as we go at the moment, Dr. Deeds. Whether wearing a turtleneck sweater and then reciting love poems to your wife after riding on a horse in your white pants on the beach, especially that time of the month, and having a pina colada and looking sensitively in your eyes is different, makes a different baby from anything else, I don't know, at this stage.
That's a good question. Thanks for the call, Deeds.
All right, thank you.
See you later, and good luck.
Thanks.
Jackie in Brisbane, good morning.
Good morning, guys.
What's your question?
I have a question about insulation. Living in Brisbane, I've got a very hot house. It's a little old cottage, and it's got a tile roof and a whirlybird, so not a lot of heat gets trapped in the roof. But I want to get insulation, but I'm just wondering if it's actually going to make the problem worse because it'll trap the heat in the ceiling, whether I'd be better off putting little holes in the ceiling and letting the hot air get sucked up into the roof cavity and out the top.
Once heat is trapped in your house, the insulation will keep it there for longer.
Yeah.
But what the insulation will do will slow down the heat entering the house during the daytime, and then if you open the windows at night, the heat can escape.
Okay.
So you're better off with the insulation. But you're absolutely correct about when the concept of letting the heat escape at some stage, having the little whirly birdy thingy on the roof, and even in the windows, at the top of your windows, a little fan to suck out the hot air at the top to let it go out. Now, normally the houses have little air vents so the hot air rises and then will go out and then hopefully be replaced by colder air. It's actually complicated because on really hot days, you're better off just shutting all the windows and then maintaining the coolth from the night before in the house.
The coolth.
Then, coolth, it's a new word, C-O-O-L-T-H.
I see.
But the trouble is that it feels a bit stuffy and you've got the smells of the house, but if you can bear to do it, that's better. But in general, always go for insulation, the thicker the better, and double glazing. We should be doing that in Australia.
Absolutely. Thanks for the call, Jackie.
Thanks, guys.
See you later. Zoe in Victoria, hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
Very well. What's your question?
I was just wondering why there's sometimes a ring of light around the moon.
Ah, high altitude, six-sided ice crystals. Tiny, tiny crystals of ice, so the water vapor turns into ice, and they're like little needles, and they've, instead of being just round like a needle, they've got six sides, like a hexagon. And if you go through the mathematics of it, it gives you this ring at that distance around the moon.
Make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Look,
just remember, high altitude hexagonal ice crystals. Just spit out like that. And if you go looking at the sun in the daytime, occasionally you can see a ring around the sun and even a rainbow around the sun. And often I see this because you go looking and you say to people, hey, look, there's a rainbow around the sun. And they look at the ground as though you're going to steal their wallet or something. Sure, see you later.
Thanks for the call, Zoe.
Look at the world. Thank
you. Good on you, mate. See you later. John's calling in from New South Wales. Hello, John.
Hello, Dr. Zan and Dr. Carroll.
Good morning. What's your question?
My question is to Dr. Carroll. Is it true that there are more people alive now than have ever died?
Ooh.
Now, I've heard this both ways. I've heard it, no, that's not true. And I've also heard it the opposite. And the latest one that I saw was just a factoid, that is to say, about as reliable as the internet, which is, once again, as reliable as a drunk guy in a pub writing in texter on the toilet wall, that the total number of people who have ever lived, and I remember reading this, was 194 billion. And I thought, that's a really big number.
Mm.
So the answer is, I don't know.
I don't even know how they'd measure that, though.
Well, you just sort of add up all of the numbers of the people going back over the last 3 million years.
A guesstimate.
And the numbers of people were really microscopic until just recently. Look, I don't know, Dr. John. I'll see what my good friend in Twitter says, because they're normally pretty good, those dudes.
Yes, if you want to answer Dr. Carl and help John out as well, you can tweet at Dr. Carl on Twitter. We'll see if we can find out before midday for you, John. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
See you later.
Bye. My son's university, Tsinghua University in Beijing, has its own lake and not one, but two coal-fired power stations.
For the university alone?
Yeah. And they've got a thing there called the Key State Planning Authority. And my son was just wandering around and he saw these vehicles coming up. And now the police have got massive presence. So this is police, not military. They've got armoured vehicles with rotating gun turrets and three chrome gun ports on each side. So you don't want to go jaywalking. And so a military vehicle came up, and then two guys in full flak jackets and bulletproof clothing and assault rifles came out, did a run around the perimeter, then went into the building and then came out and then went back in the building. And then a little bit later, the doors opened, and then two more guys in assault rifles and the whole kit came out and then escorted this man in a suit into the Key State Planning Laboratory, and then did the whole thing in reverse again the other way. So there's all sorts of things going on there. Like, you can tell definitely that they like to be in control of their society, and there are advantages and disadvantages to that.
Absolutely. Well, you're in the freedom of Australia now, Dr. Carl, and talking silence freely on Triple J. Let's get into some more questions. Cameron in Port Macquarie, good morning.
Morning, Dr. Carl, Dr. Zan.
Hello,
Dr.
what's your Cameron? Question?
I had a bleed in my brain about 4 years ago, and I was paralysed down the right side. And now when I wake up in the morning and on a cold day, my right leg that I was paralysed in is a lot colder than the other one, and it seems to be cold all the time.
Ah, was this a berry aneurysm?
AVM, arteriovenous malformation.
Oh, you had one from birth, and it just popped.
It popped, yeah.
Okay, so what happens is that you've got, just for a background here, you've got arteries which have thick walls and handle pressure really well. And then you've got veins, which you've got thin little walls. There's no pressure. But occasionally, and in between, you've got the end organ, which can be a muscle or the heart or the brain. But sometimes you get an AVM, where an artery with its thick walls and high pressure joins directly onto a vein.
Yep.
And the high pressure gets transmitted into the vein. Yeah. It's not made to take it. And it just pops. And so all I can say is that in your particular case, by the way, are you recovering well? Have you got...
I've probably got about 95% of my movement in my leg and 100% in my arm.
Wow.
But it's just the toes. I have trouble with it from the calf muscle down. It's a bit... It's not bad. It's just a bit slower than the rest.
Okay. And you're saying that when you wake up in the morning sometimes, your right arm is cold?
No, my arm's fine. It's just my foot. You know when you get cold feet in the bed? Yeah, like every morning and every night it's cold.
What if you wear socks to bed?
Yeah, it still wakes up cold.
All I can say in that case is that you've probably damaged the nerves that register temperature, or you've damaged the nerves that control how the blood vessels open and close. Yeah. You've got about 100,000 kilometres of blood vessels in your body, most of them in the skin. And at any given time, only about 5% of them are open. And then a few minutes later, a different 5% are open. And they can vary, they can change from being 100% of them open, which is really rare. You've got to be in a sauna or running or sweating, and you've got every single blood vessel open in an effort to get rid of heat. Or they're all closed down, which happens when you go into cold weather. And it could well be that that circuitry has been slightly damaged.
Thanks for the call, Cameron.
That's my best guess.
No, thank you.
Thank you, and glad you're getting better.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cameron.
Jacqueline in Morwell, hello.
Hi.
What's your question for Dr. Carl?
Well, I have this puppy. She's 9 months old. She's like the size of a fully grown dog already, and she just high jumps our fence all the time. And comes and goes as she pleases. I was just wondering, when she's bigger, do you reckon she'll still be able to jump the fence?
Because of her weight?
Well, she's a Mastiff Cross Great Dane, so she's going to be really, like, taller.
Mm.
So will the weight, like, be able to make her not be able to jump the fence?
Well, it's funny you should mention that. But a while ago, I love going down to the snowy in the summertime and walking through the mountains down there, bearing in mind that it can snow even in summer, if you're unlucky. And we went to the Jindabyne State, or the Jindabyne Fair, or the Festival of whatever it was, and I saw for the first time in my life the sport called the dog high jump, where they built a wall on the back of a ute, and then they got the dogs to come up to it. Man, they can scramble over a 2 meter, 3 meter high wall. I think it's because they've got four-wheel drive. And so as they get bigger, they get more strength, but then they get more weight. And I noticed that the dogs that were at the best at doing it, getting over really tall walls, were maybe your middle-sized dog. Your little dogs just didn't have enough reach, and your big dogs had too much weight but didn't have correspondingly extra great muscle mass in proportion. So you've got a big dog, and I reckon it won't be able to be a winner in the dog high jumps down at Jindabyne, but I reckon it'll still be able to scramble over a fence that you or I would have a lot of difficulty in getting over.
Thanks for the call, Jacqueline, and good luck.
Thank you.
See you later. Yeah. Earlier we were just talking about the concept of consciousness and memory and exactly where it is, whether it's in the brain or whether it's out there. Scott in Melbourne's got a question on that consciousness. Hello, Scott.
Hello, how you going?
Good, thanks. What's your question for Carl?
I'm just wondering about it. If consciousness could exist out of the body, would that explain ghosts?
There's never been any really good evidence for ghosts that stands up when you try applying hard science at it. But maybe it's just that our science is not good enough, but I tend to think that there probably aren't ghosts. It's easy to make people see ghosts if you hit them with certain infrasound. Like you can have a long underground passageway and the wind blowing over an access chimney, and you can set up a resonant frequency that's so low you can't hear it, and your brain begins to go funny. And when the frequency goes really high, you start sensing ghosts.
Yep.
This consciousness thing is really difficult, and it's bothered me for a long time. And we were walking across Spain with this guy who was an anaesthetist. And he told me about an article, and he sent it to me. And if you're interested in this, it's worthwhile reading. It's called The Entwined Mysteries of Anesthesia and Consciousness. And it's in the journal called Anesthesiology. Okay, that's an American name for you. 2006, volume 105, pages 400 to 412. And this whole thing of consciousness, we don't understand. We don't understand how anesthetics work. We don't know how anesthetics prevent consciousness. But are they related to ghosts? Don't know. No proof of it as of yet.
What about with full apparitions and stuff like that? Will full on see ghosts moving about and what have you?
Yes, but then when you try and subject to some sort of scientific analysis in there, the whole thing falls over.
Okay.
No, there's a guy called James Randi who's got a standing offer of $1 million. If you can prove in any scientific way that you have any sort of paranormal ability, or if you can prove the existence of ghosts.
Okay.
And people say, I can see auras around people. And you say, really? And you say, what if I put a bit of cardboard in them? Can you see the aura around them outside the cardboard? And they say, sure. And you say, okay, I'll put the cardboard out. And then sometimes you have the people there and sometimes not. They can't tell. It's never stood up to scientific testing. That doesn't mean it's not real. It might be real.
As yet unproved, though. And that's what we're talking about at 11 a.m. on Thursday mornings. Thanks for the call, Scott.
Thank you.
See you later, mate. Sue in Kiama, good morning.
Good morning, Dr. Zand, Dr. Carl.
Dr. Sue, what's your question?
My question is, why does it rain after there's like earthquakes or volcano eruptions, and not so much tsunamis or bushfires, but it always seems to rain. I've noticed when there's a big earthquake in Pakistan, there's always really heavy rain after that seems to hamper the efforts.
I haven't noticed this, Carl, have you?
No, you'd have to work out what the average rainfall is for that area at that time of year and then measure it before and afterwards. But I imagine you're saying you're looking at the video footage and the poor buggers are in their refugee camps and it's raining like crazy.
And it's always raining. And so, say, in Pakistan, it had a relatively low rainfall.
Mm-hmm.
And it, I just thought maybe the earthquakes affected the air in some way, like in a meteorological way.
Yeah. Look, the magic word here, Sue, is nucleation, or the magic words are nucleation centres. So you can have some water, and it's in a stove, and it just wants to boil, but not quite, and you get some finely grained coffee powder, dust, cement, anything, and drop it in, and it suddenly just erupts. Or you can have a whole bunch of water vapour in what's called a Wilson cloud chamber, and you can have a cosmic ray coming through, and it splits an atom into something else, so two smaller atoms, and blow me down, you can see this trail of condensation behind it. So it could well be that the earthquake might have put some very fine dust into the atmosphere, act as nucleation centres, and rain was pregnant, wanting to come out of the clouds, and that just gave that little extra push. That sounds
pregnant
one possible
rain.
Theory.
Love
yeah,
it.
Pregnant rain, as with the volcanoes as well.
Volcanoes especially.
Yeah. All right, great question. Thanks for the call,
Thank
Sue.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you,
all right, time to get through a couple more questions with Dr. Carl this morning. Brock in Singleton, good morning.
Hey,
good. What's your question?
My question is, how come is it that the Earth, Moon, and Sun, and all the planets are all round shaped since the beginning of time? Why is it that they have been a sphere shape?
Dr. Carl.
Yeah, for the same reason that when water comes out of a tap, it's all neatly rolled up into a ball. In the case of the water coming out of the tap, you've got surface tension, which is providing an inward force. When the planets are forming, they're molten, and they've got the surface tension on the molten rock providing an inward force, but your main factor is the gravity.
Because there's an even amount of gravity on each side.
Well, yeah, and they're big enough. So that has now become part of the definition of a planet, that it is big enough that it can force itself by gravity alone, and not just forget the surface tension thing, just by gravity alone into a circular shape. So if you've got something that's 200 kilometres across, maybe it could be shaped like a peanut shell, two big ends and a little bit in the middle.
Yep.
But if it's 4,000 kilometres across, it'll suck itself down by gravity, and the high mountains shall be pulled down and the valleys raised up. It almost sounds biblical, like Handel's Messiah.
Okay, so it's just from the sheer size.
And the gravity. The gravity pulls down the high bits.
Thanks for the call, Brock.
No worries.
See you, mate. Tyrone's calling in from Sydney. Hello, Tyrone.
G'day, Dr. Zhang. G'day, Dr. Carl. How are you?
Good. What's your question?
Dr. Tyrone.
On Monday, actually, I was on top of a sand dune with six other friends, and all of our hair just went, say, 30 centimetres above our heads. That was like the hair was floating. It was during an electrical storm. So I was wondering, how does lightning have anything to do with static?
Oh, God. I rang my wife, and she told me the same thing happened to her in a lightning storm. And I was in the airport at Hong Kong thinking, don't get to the bad bit. There's a famous physics textbook called Resnick and Halliday.
Okay.
And it's been going on for years. And it's got different authors with time. And inside the front cover, opposite the table of contents, is a picture of a woman with her hair standing up. How long was your hair standing up, by the way, Dr. Tyrone?
Well, mine is actually pretty short, but a few of the girls and a friend of mine, theirs was easily a good 30 centimetres above their head. Some of the strands of the hair was straight on the girls who had straight hair.
You are so lucky to be alive.
That hairstyle is so in right now, if anybody's seen any LaRue video clips lately.
And that's what we were thinking at the time.
And the picture in this physics textbook says, it shows a woman with her hair standing out in all directions, just like you've described. And the caption underneath says, she stopped at a lookout in Colorado and noticed that her hair was standing up. She got her boyfriend to take a photograph of this unusual phenomenon, and then they got in the car and drove away. And a few moments later, a bolt of lightning hit the lookout, killing several people.
Wow. So it's a precursor.
It's a precursor of a big storm. And what you should do when you see this thing happening, Dr. Tyrone, and for everybody else who's listening, what you should do is get down into a little ball. Don't lie flat on the ground. Don't run, because you'll just get killed by the lightning bolt while you're running. Don't lie flat, because you're
like
going to have different...
It's like a horror movie.
People get killed by lightning. I'm telling you how to not get killed.
So what does getting into a little ball, what does that actually do? How does that
It means that you've got a single point of contact with the ground. And if a lightning bolt hits the ground near you, your whole body gets lifted up to 100 volts, 100,000 volts per meter, and then it gets dropped down again. And you will not die from differential voltage across your heart. In near Dorigo a couple of years ago, a lightning bolt hit a tree, and a whole bunch of cows died who were not hit by the lightning bolt. And so imagine they're facing the tree, and then the lightning bolt hits the tree, and the electricity spreads out in all directions. And their feet, which are closest to the tree, experience, we'll say, 1,000,000 volts per meter, and the field gets weaker as it gets further away from the tree. And so their back legs, which are further away, experience 500,000 volts per meter. So between the front legs and the back legs is 500,000 volts per meter, and that appears across the heart, and it kills them. So what the cows should do if a tree gets hit by lightning is balance on one foot, which is virtually impossible. So in the case of a human, crouch down into a ball. Don't lie flat on the ground. Crouch down on the ground. And this is a really scary thing. And as my wife was telling me this, she was all excited. I was thinking, oh, God, please don't let anything bad happen. And Tyrone, I'm so glad you didn't die, but you know what to
death,
do
Tyrone.
Next time.
Well
you
done.
You cheated death.
Thanks for
Take a lottery ticket.
Yeah, buy a lottery ticket. Not that I condone gambling. Thanks for the call, Tyrone. And thank you, Dr. Carl. We will see you back talking science 11 a.m. next Thursday.
Peachy keen.